It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Seattle has a new police chief designate. This week, Mayor Jenny Durkan chose Carmen Best, a 25-year veteran of the SPD. We're joined by Mayor Durkan and Carmen Best. Welcome to both of you.
So great to be here.
And Carmen Best, congratulations to you. This must be a great week for you.
It's been a wonderful week. Thank you. I'm very, very excited.
One concern about your appointment was that your longstanding service with the Seattle Police Department might make it difficult for you to take some of the reform steps still necessary. Here's how lawyer and former mayoral candidate Nikita Oliver put it.
Well, she made a great case as to who she is and how she's worked in the city and how everybody knows her and a lot of people love her. Reality is the sort of reforms that need to be pushed forward in the Seattle Police Department require someone who's going to be willing to take a heavy hand.
Carmen Best, will you as chief need to take a heavy hand to continue these reforms?
Well, I'm going to assume that that means, you know, in regards to discipline. And what I can tell you is that I want to make sure that we hold everybody accountable in the department for good, fair, and just policing. That is a priority. At the same time, I'm going to make sure that officers have the support that they need to do their job with equity and fairness and justice. And that is where I stand, and I think that is going to move us forward for a continued culture of innovation and improvement within the organization.
Ross, I would echo that with the chief. One of the main reasons that I selected her was we've worked together on these issues for a long period of time, including when we were doing reform efforts. And Carmen was one of the people in the department, had to be quiet at the time, but who was a strong ally in making sure that we got the reforms in place under the consent decree. We can't afford to lose any ground under that, and I have every confidence that Chief Best knows how to not just make the reforms stick, but how to continually innovate and become a better police department.
Let's talk about that. The Seattle Police has been under a Justice Department consent order to reduce biased policing and unnecessary use of force. Earlier this year, a federal judge found that the Seattle Police Department has fulfilled its responsibilities, but now these reforms have to be sustained for another 2 years. Mayor Durkan, you're a former U.S. attorney for Western Washington. You're familiar with this process. What's going to be the most challenging part of sustaining those reforms for the next 2 years?
Yeah, and Ross, you know, I think I'm probably the only mayor in the country whose police department is under a consent decree that I signed as U.S. attorney. So I am very, very familiar with the obligations, and being in the courtroom last week was a really good thing to remind all of us that we have a strong obligation towards the federal court, towards the community, and towards the officers to make sure that we do it right under the consent decree so that we can get it lifted in 2 years. So keeping sustainment, the thing that we've talked about, the chief and I, is this is not just a checkbox process. We want to make sure that we don't just stay in compliance, that we're continually looking at what are those other areas that we need to continue to improve. How do we make sure, for example, that we have both officer wellness and better engagement with the community? How do we build community trust in the police department? All of these things are things that aren't one of the boxes you check to stay in sustainment, but if we don't do those things, we won't have the police department that Seattle deserves.
I think there's agreement that the death of Charlena Lyles at the hands of Seattle police was a terrible outcome, but some point to it as being emblematic of the Seattle Police Department's continued use of unnecessary force. Carmen Best, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with you that it was a terrible, terrible tragedy, and one that really shook a lot of people. A lot of folks walked away from there. Pretty much everyone walked away from there feeling devastated about the incident. One of the things that we're always doing is looking to continually approve and any responses that we have so that we can be better at responding at these types of things. The department is going to continue, as the mayor said, not just to check a box, but to move forward on building trust and legitimacy with the community that we serve. And the Charlena Lyles incident, while very, very tragic, an incident we're going to continue to look at to help us get better at responding at these types of things.
The police officers' union has been viewed by some as an impediment to reform. Previous Seattle police chiefs have disciplined officers only to have those decisions reversed by union appeals. Carmen Best, how do you exercise authority at the department when your personnel decisions can be undone?
Well, I don't think there's a chief across America that isn't dealing with that very issue. But what I will tell you is that any decision that I make will be made to hold people accountable. It will be fair, it'll be just, and it will be something that makes sure that people are accountable to the community that we serve and that we're doing the job that we need to do. I don't have control outside of the, with that process, but my decision making will always be fair and just.
Mayor Durkan, what are your thoughts on that? The police officers' union is sometimes perceived as kind of hampering reform efforts. What do you think?
Well, two things. One, I echo what the chief says in terms of her ability to hold people accountable. And one of the things that she and I have talked about that is once she's confirmed, there's a process by which the new chief coming in can hit the reset button and make sure that the old discipline matrix don't apply to her ability to hold people accountable, which she wants to do to make sure that everyone knows she's chief. In terms of the Officers Guild being an impediment, we're at the table with them right now trying to get a contract, and we've been working with them on a range of issues. I think what the public needs to understand is while they believe that there are things happening in reform that affected their workplace and therefore have to be bargained and that they've gone without a contract for 3 years, police officers are not standing in the way of reform. They are wearing the body cameras. They're going through the de-escalation training. They're working with the crisis intervention people. And it's, you know, we are having thousands of interactions between people in crisis and the police every year, and yet we're performing very well. We've had tragedies that we have to learn from, for example, the death of Charlena Lyles, but literally lives have been saved because of not just the training, but what the officers are doing on the street. And so I think what people need to know is I'm pretty optimistic about our ability to move forward with the Guild.
Carmen Best, does the diversity in the Seattle Police Department reflect the diversity of the city it serves?
Yeah, we're working really hard to make sure that the police department reflects the community that we serve. And in most areas, we're doing pretty okay on that, but a few areas where we need to improve, and we're working really hard to have the strategies in place with our human resources folks and our recruiters to make sure that we are intentionally and deliberately bringing in a wide variety of people into the department that reflect the community that we serve. It's been very clear both in the past and certainly with our new mayor that this is a priority for us.
What are the areas where you would like to see more diversity, Carmen Best?
Well, obviously, I like to see more women in the department and certainly more people of color in certain areas as well, in areas where we might not have as many as we could. And we're just always looking to bring in as many people to reflect the community, as I said earlier, as we possibly can. We're being very deliberate about that.
Do you live in Seattle, Carmen Best?
Yes, I have a place in Seattle.
And do a large percentage of Seattle police live outside the city?
More live outside the city than live within the city.
Is that a problem?
I don't see that as a problem. I think the work, as the mayor said earlier, the officers are doing the work that we're asking them to do. They're wearing the body-worn cameras. They're reducing the uses of force in the field. They're utilizing de-escalation. They're all involved in crisis intervention. So the service that the community is getting from the officers is good service, regardless of where they reside.
Mayor Durkan, what's your read on the council? Do you foresee a smooth council approval process for Police Chief Designate Carmen Best?
I do. I think that Chief Best has broad support on the council. We'll have the first hearings next week. I think you'll see a lot of support from people throughout the city for her nomination. I think you'll see it from officers like rank and file, but also the chief and I have been out the last 2 days walking in all parts of the city, just meeting with people, talking to people. And I will tell you that people feel good about her as chief. They feel good about what she means to the department. I think that having this change at this time in the city of Seattle is a really positive thing. I mean, we are, in many ways, it's very historic. I think that of the top 20 cities in America, we will be the only city that has a woman mayor and woman chief of police, which is a historic thing, which I think people can be proud of. And I also think we're going to continue to build. I echo what Chief Best said on diversity. We need to do better there. We need to find ways to recruit people because ultimately that helps put trust in the department if people see people like themselves. And so we're really looking at how do we, for example, have more Native Americans on the police department because that's an area we're very much lacking. How do we make sure we have immigrant and refugees represented, whether it's the East African community, the Somalian community, whoever it is. So we're looking at all those things and ways we can do. We're stealing ideas from some of the other candidates. And we're gonna continue to move forward and build the best department to be even better. I'll close with one thing, Ross, is part of the process we went through to choose the chief of police is a site selection selection team went out to all of the sites where the candidates came from. So the same people went to Pittsburgh and Austin and Wisconsin and really were doing in-depth review of the candidates. And it included former council member and mayor Tim Burgess. And when they came back, their views of Carmen Best went up even more because our police department is considered a national leader. And we are so much further along on the reforms of having a modern police department, which doesn't mean we can't do more.
Right.
We know we have to do more, but we are really doing much better than other parts of the country.
Mayor Jenny Durkin and Acting Police Chief and Police Chief Designate Carmen Best, thank you so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ross.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's no secret that homelessness is one of the biggest issues facing the region today. As the Puget Sound area has grown, so has the problem. It's been 2 years since a state of emergency was declared, but for the most part, homelessness has only gotten worse. Seattle Day of Homelessness is a collaboration by local newsrooms to focus on our regional homelessness crisis. And I'm joined by three of the reporters from Seattle Day of Homelessness Project. Kate Walters from KUOW, Scott Greenstone from the Seattle Times, David Croman from Crosscut KCTS. Thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Hey, Ross.
Thank you.
Scott, I want to start with you. You're with the Seattle Times, and you focused on my neighborhood of Ballard. It's had one of the largest influxes of people experiencing homeless. Do we know why that increase has taken place in that neighborhood?
Yeah, so the numbers went up, they quadrupled from 2017 to 2018, at least the count of homeless folks did. And when I talked to caseworkers and folks themselves, the biggest reasons that I heard were folks were being swept throughout the city, different, you know, places on the edges of the city, the jungle, things like that. And then folks were also avoiding downtown and Soto, some places where they had had bad experiences, really anxiety-inducing experiences. You know, we hear a lot of complaints about, oh, downtown, there are lots of homeless folks, it's really crowded. A lot of homeless folks I talked to had those same complaints, and they had a lot of anxiety associated with going back downtown. So they came to Ballard because Ballard is a little bit quieter. There are some services. There's a meal. There's an urban rest stop. And a lot of folks who live in RVs, they can legally park in the industrial district down by the Ballard waterfront for 24 hours. So it was one of those places where folks felt a little bit safer.
Well, there are services, but there are so many more people. Are the services keeping up with the number of people who need the services?
So definitely not, because a lot of them are church-run and church-funded services. I talked to some folks at St. Luke's Episcopal, which is right by Ballard Commons Park and the Ballard Public Library, where a lot of folks camp, and they are really struggling to keep up with the demand. They said that I talked to the priest, and she said that when she came there in 2015, the most people they had ever served was 80, and now the average is 175. And she said, honestly, I don't know how we're keeping up with the demand.
You know, one thing I've noticed just as a resident is that one strategy appears to be putting chain link fences underneath the Ballard Bridge. There used to be homeless camps there. Now they're just empty and surrounded by fences where homeless people apparently used to be. What's the point there? And I'm curious what you've seen that in other parts of the city too. Why do that?
Yeah. So, you know, when SDOT fenced off that area under the Ballard Bridge, the north end of the Ballard Bridge, it was, you know, to keep out folks who were camping under there in cars. And, you know, there had been some of the arguments that SDOT made for that was there had been fires in RVs under freeways in Soto. And so they were worried about a fire or something dangerous happening down there. But a lot of folks who are advocates for the homeless say if you fence them out of this area, they're just going to go somewhere else. And it becomes kind of a cat and mouse game around the city. And, you know, so they go to places where they're not going to be fenced out, like the sidewalk of the Ballard Public Library, where I saw a lot of folks.
And people get rousted out a lot, either by fences or their camps just get moved along. Did the city keep track of where they go? Okay.
So I spent a little time with the navigation team, which is sort of the main team that goes to encampments and either helps out with connecting them with services or on the other side of it helps with shutting those camps down when they decide that they're too dangerous or in a public right of way, things like that. And they The short answer is basically no. It's very difficult to track where people go. So they keep track of if someone that they offered services to accepted that service. They call the shelter that night and say, hey, you know, did so-and-so show up? And they'll get a yes, but then they don't know whether the next night that person's back on the street, if they're back on the street in the same area where they just moved them from, if they got into housing, what happened. So it's this very kind of disjointed tracking of folks. And that's partly because of resources, it's partly because of privacy, it's partly because we just don't have everything together when it comes to data at this point.
Kate Walters, you've been working this beat for a while, and your focus recently was on the neighborhood where we are today in the University District. It's traditionally been home to a lot of homeless youth, and you focused on youth and the young adult population. You found kind of a mixed story when it comes to the numbers of those homeless folks, haven't you?
Yeah, so when you look at the one-night count numbers, and again, this is a snapshot on any given night, but it gives us a sense of sort of where we are year to year. You look at those numbers for the youth and young adult population, and these are people under 25 who are out without their families. So we're not talking about kids in families, we're talking about people from like 12 to 24 who are out on their own. And that population is sort of split in terms of minors, people under 18, and people 18 to 24 years old. And we saw successes this year with the under 18 population. That population went down by about 20%.
Do we know why?
Yeah, so basically what I heard from people was that there was a more targeted approach for those younger people. You know, they were really getting in there and looking at what individuals needed, but also state and federal funding. The state has put a lot of money towards helping unaccompanied minors get off the streets. So that really helps in terms of the kinds of services that can be provided. We didn't see the same thing for 18 to 24 year olds. That population went up a little bit in the one night count numbers. And so there are sort of some questions there about whether what happened with the younger population can be replicated.
Sure.
And county officials say that yes, they're working on it. They want to do that, but we just don't know if that's going to work.
Well, of course, there's not a homeless population. There's homeless populations. And David Croman from Crosscut, you focused on folks who are veterans, and there's also a little bit of a success story there.
Yeah, it's especially over the last year, while the rest of the sort of broader homeless population went up by about 4%, the number of veterans experiencing homelessness went down by 31%, which, you know, the population is not as large, so in raw numbers, I think that was about, you know, 400 less than it was the year before, but fairly significant. And I think sort of like what Kate was getting at with some of the younger populations is, you know, veteran homelessness really attracts a lot of bipartisan support. There's not a lot of controversy at really any level in supporting that. And so the system does just have a lot more money and resources from a bunch of different levels. So federal, VA money, state puts in a decent amount of money. The King County has a levy that's sort of specifically focused on veteran homelessness. So you get that. And then plus there's just like a lot, also what Kate was talking about, there's a lot more coordination in that system.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all shamed by any homelessness, but particularly veterans who've served the country, there's a particular shame to that. You both mentioned in these cases where we've seen some success, part of it just was due to more money going into the system. Is that to say that if that kind of money was going into other sectors of the homeless population that are not decreasing, we could see the same success? You're kind of nodding your head, Kate, not sure.
I'm bubbling my head.
I mean,
I think the money has a lot to do with it, but I think the approach is also different, and it takes time as well as money. So you're looking at resources beyond just the dollars. I do think the dollars make sense. But I mean, I'm sure you saw, David, with the veteran population, the process is pretty different mm-hmm. when it comes to how they're getting those people off the streets and into housing and resources.
Yeah, one person sort of put it to me as, you know, the money's great, but it doesn't mean a lot if you don't sort of coordinate that money. And so what the veteran response has been able to do is they have this, what they call a by name list. So they actually are much more effective at kind of cataloging individuals. And, you know, they try and get every veteran experiencing homelessness on this list by name. And so, and then, you know, all the different providers of veteran homelessness around the region all have access to this list, and they meet on a weekly basis, and they sort of pore over this list, and they discuss with one another where are the gaps, where could this person fit in. They're able to use that list to connect people who need it with what are essentially Section 8 vouchers, but sort of set aside specifically for veterans.
And those vouchers allow you to get into an apartment house. It helps pay your rent.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so I think there's the money, but it really helps that that money is specifically earmarked for veterans. So there's not really a lot of competition for the resources that they do have, and that every service provider knows who all these people are. And, you know, I think that that does sort of create efficiencies in the system that, in combination with the additional money, seem to be having a positive effect.
David Crumman's with Crosscut and KCTS. Kate Walters is with KUOW, and also with us in the studio, Scott Greenstone from the Seattle Times. They've all been working on Seattle Day of Homelessness. If you've picked up a paper today or looked at a website, you're going to see a lot of emphasis and focus on it. We're just kind of scratching the surface of this. Check out your local news outlets to find out a lot more. You knew something about this going into this reporting project, but I'm curious, was there anything that really surprised you from the reporting that you did, Scott?
Yeah, I think what surprised me is, so again, I looked just at Ballard and really tried to take that as a microcosm of the city. But what surprised me is how much folks do tend to agree on a lot of the fixes. They just don't tend to agree on things like law enforcement. It really is, you know, I brought this question up to people who have been very vocal when they criticize the city about how the city is dealing with this stuff. I said, you know, it seems like you all agree on things like there needs to be more affordable housing for folks. It seems like you agree that most of these folks, they shouldn't be in jail. They should have treatment for drug addiction or mental health disorders. So why is it that, you know, as you've probably seen in the last year and a half in Ballard, it's gotten very loud. There are a lot of people that are very frustrated. Why has that happened? And they said, you know, we think that the big thing is that people disagree about law enforcement.
That's really interesting. So, David and Kate, have you had was that also surprise you? There seemed to be actually agreement on what to do, but disagreement about how laws are being enforced?
I mean, I think there is agreement. One thing that I hear whenever I do stories about this is the affordable housing bell being rung. Every single person you talk to says we just don't have enough housing. And I think there is some agreement on kind of what we need to do. I think people just have very different opinions about how we get there and how resources should be focused and where those resources should come from, as we saw with the head tax debate. I will say that the housing part is a huge reason that we see populations succeeding, because when there's housing vouchers available for a specific population, then, you know, the market doesn't play into it quite as much. So
I want to circle back to the law enforcement part, because we've heard a lot of citizens say, oh, a homeless camp came into my neighborhood and crime went up. Do we actually know the facts about these stories that we're hearing, David? Is it factually true that there's some kind of correlation between homeless populations and crime, or do we not know? What do we?
You know, I haven't written a ton about this, but from what I've, you know, there have been a few different reports, media reports about that. And they're, it's not to say that crime never goes up in neighborhoods where there are also people who are homeless,
right.
But drawing a direct
correlation. But it could have gone
up anyway. Right, exactly. Yeah. I have never seen any sort of direct proof that there is any correlation between those two. And in fact, I think it was The Guardian had a story about tent encampments in Seattle and Portland. And, you know, there, for the most part, in fact, in a few of the neighborhoods, crime went down when these tent encampments came in. You know, there were a few instances where crime went up, but the sort of takeaway point of that piece was it's really difficult to draw direct correlation. And a lot of times, I think what people will point out when this issue is brought up is really the people who are most likely to be the victims of crime are the people who are sleeping on the streets, the homeless people themselves.
Yeah, you hear a lot of times about people who have had their stuff stolen, you know, IDs have been taken, things like that. I think there's definitely the two sides to it. I would also say, though, and we saw a piece in the Times about this recently, perception is really important when it comes to this. When you look at the perception of crime rates versus actual crime rates, if people perceive them to be higher, it's going to impact the way that they interact and the way that they react when someone says, hey, we want to put a camp in your neighborhood. So that piece of this, I think, is one of the biggest takeaways. When I go to community meetings, I constantly hear locals saying the data that SPD gives us doesn't match up with our experience.
Mm-hmm. There's a big debate over tiny house encampments. We actually approached that this week on The Record. Advocates say these are an economical way to get people shelter. Critics say they're not as effective at getting people into permanent housing as they should be. Just this week, Scott, your paper reported that there are not caseworkers for a couple of months at a tiny house encampment, kind of a crucial piece of getting them into permanent housing. I'm not looking for your opinion necessarily, but what do you think is relevant for people to consider in this debate over should we spend money on tiny houses or should we shift that money over to permanent housing? What do you think, Scott?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is most of these folks don't have a place to go. When I did a story on the Licton Springs Village up in North Seattle, a little north of Ballard, the biggest thing when I was talking to people who lived there is that they had been in a camp. The camp was cleaned up and a police officer came through with a REACH caseworker or something like that. And the caseworker said, hey, do you want to go to this tiny house village? You can, you can stay there. And so because they had a spot in the tiny house village, they weren't camping outside. So I think that's one relevant thing that the advocates often bring up is this is better than having someone camping in a green belt or something like that. But obviously, like you said, it doesn't seem to be the best case scenario, or at least a lot of experts nationally and a lot of folks at the local level seem to say that it's really not the best case scenario. It seems to, at best, be a stopgap.
Kate, David, what can you add to this debate that we should think about when we're thinking about tiny house encampments?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I would say is that what I hear over and over again is that stabilization is key to being able to get someone from the streets into housing. When you are constantly in survival mode, you don't necessarily have the brain space to be able to get everything together so that you can get into a house or get into treatment or whatever it is that you need to do. On the flip side, there has been criticism and there is this question about whether or not diverting resources to a service like this is in the long run going to help us to solve this problem. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword in my mind.
And the federal government has basically determined that tiny houses don't qualify as proper housing. And So as a result, and I think it was mostly your paper, Scott, that reported on this, but the result being the city and the county are actually at risk of losing some of that funding because while people may be moving into these tiny houses on paper, they have not actually been moved into permanent housing. And so if you're looking at performance goals or meeting those performance goals by moving people into these villages, you actually risk sort of losing some funding.
I want to talk more about the different populations of homeless people. Some years ago, the Seattle Times reported on the small population of chronic street alcoholics costing the city millions of dollars a year. And one thing that came out of that was what they called wet housing, apartments so they could get off the street. And some of the studies showed that this reduced the cost, and it also gave them a pathway to getting treatment. They didn't all get into treatment, but it was determined to be helpful. And as far as I know, that's still holds. Is there any kind of focused approach being done in the area of homelessness for people who have just been on the street for so long? Is this a different population that you have to have different solutions for?
Yeah, I would say, again, Licton Springs Village was a little bit of that kind of thing. The problem is, you know, that was years ago,
right,
when people were mostly talking about street folks living on the street who are alcoholics. And now what's really grown is the section of the population that is has a substance use disorder, is using opioids, that kind of thing. And, you know, that's a little bit harder and a lot more controversial. So like Licton Springs Village, even though it was a tiny home encampment and not a full-on facility like a room, all that stuff, like 1811 Eastlake, like what you were talking about a few years ago, it was controversial because people were saying, well, you're just giving these people a place to shoot up until they die. That was essentially the argument from a lot of the neighbors, and I'm paraphrasing their words. But so it can be really controversial because I think a lot of folks, they really have a strong, especially the neighbors around these tiny home villages or facilities, they really have a strong problem with giving people a place where they can, you know, simply do drugs.
Reporting can lead to more questions. You find out things, but you also find out things you didn't get the answers to. From your reporting that you've done, are there some major things that kind of stick in your mind? I really couldn't figure this out. This is something I'd like to know the answer to. David?
Yeah, I think so. The veteran homelessness population, what's sort of celebrated about their response is this list of this by name list. So they sort of have a good track on everybody who's on that list. And I think that's seen as sort of a best practice that can be expanded potentially to other demographics.
Just keeping track of them.
Right. But my question with that, and, you know, in speaking with some service providers, is as that list gets bigger, is that can they sort of keep track of those people? And, you know, when I was asking about this, one of the things I was hearing was that, yeah, I mean, the more names you have on the list, the sort of less wieldy it can be. So I think veteran homelessness is seen by a lot of people as a good model for other demographics. But a big question mark for me is how well their approach can scale up to handle sort of a larger population of people.
Kate, how about you? What's a question about homelessness you weren't able to answer that you'd like to be able to?
Yeah, so one of the things that I saw when looking at the youth and young adult population is that the paths into homelessness for those people are, they're different, right? So we see a lot of system involvement. A third of youth and young adults who are on the street without parents are coming out of, have been in foster care at some point. Some of them actually age out onto the streets. Half of them have been incarcerated at some point. So the county is planning to spend some federal funding they got on sort of intervening upstream in these systems to look at, like, what if we get to the young people before they even reach the brink of homelessness, if they're in foster care, if they're in juvie, if they're in schools? And my question is that something that we will see? Like, will that work? And then also, could that be replicated in terms of, if we can stem the flow for this population, can we stem the flow for others? Is that actually a way to go about this instead of always churning on the back end?
Scott, how about you? An unanswered question that you're really curious about.
That's a great question. I have so many, I feel. I really want to understand more about how bankruptcy has affected a lot of folks, especially, I think, medical bankruptcy. I talked to so many folks out there on the streets. I talked to this one man, and actually, you all did a story on him. His name is Robert Loomis. He now volunteers at St. Luke's Episcopal. And years ago, he had six-way heart bypass surgery. It was $480,000, and he ended up on the streets. He was staying in a car just blocks away from where he used to own a home in Ballard. And, you know, I think there are tons of folks like that for whom the healthcare system is bankrupting them, and they have no option but to go out on the streets. And I would like to know more and talk to more of those folks to give us a really good idea. Obviously, like, homelessness is incredibly complicated. It's really not one thing. It's not even five things. It seems like it's a different thing for every person.
Yeah.
And but this one has come up again and again as one particular driver. And I would love to know more about those folks.
Scott Greenstone with the Seattle Times, David Krohman with Crosscut and KCTS, and KUOW's own Kate Walters. They're part of this big reporting project called Seattle Day of Homelessness. Check out the work of these reporters and more at the websites of KUOW, the Seattle Times, and also at the Seattle PI. Hey, thanks a lot for stopping by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke all week. It's an 1,100-mile drive from Port Townsend up to Ketchikan, Alaska. You can shave 350 miles off the trip, but there is a catch. You have to sail. The Race to Alaska invites sailors to try it, but there's a condition. No motorized power allowed. Well, an eight-woman team called Sail Like a Girl just won that race, arriving at the destination in less than a week. This trip involved log collisions, recumbent bikes, sleep deprivation, among other things. Here to tell us more about it, Jean Gusev, Amy Fulwell, and Allison Ekberg-Jvadlidze. I kind of got it, roughly. So first of all, how did each of you get involved in this team? Are you, like, experienced sailors?
This is Jean. I've been sailing for about 20 years, and this idea was concocted after a sailing race with Anna. Anna and Morgana and I were all sitting together after the race, and she asked if we would be interested in doing the Race to Alaska with an all-women's team.
Mm-hmm. And so you're pretty experienced. You've been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years, and started in Boston and then came out here to the West Coast and have been racing. My husband and I have a boat together that we do quite a bit of sailing on.
And how about you, Amy, an experienced sailor?
No, not one bit. I've done tons of water sports, ranging from rowing to whitewater rafting to scuba diving to swimming to kayaking. But sailing's never been one of those things that I've done in the past. But it's something I've always wanted to do. And Jean had made mention of this conversation with Anna and Morgana one night. And I said, you know what? even though I don't have the experience, I'm super driven, I'm super athletic, I take direction well, and I do things 150%. If you're interested in having someone like that in the crew, I want to be a part of it.
And how about you, Allison? What got you in?
Yeah, so I grew up on Bainbridge Island and was on the water most of my life, and I windsurfed and sailed as a kid, and then as an adult lived in places where that wasn't an option, and it's something that I always wanted to get back to. And, you know, having met Jean a few years ago, started sailing with Jean and her family, and just fell in love. I mean, was still in love with it. So again, jumped at the opportunity to do something with a group of women who were all driven and equally committed to the race.
Were you guys in it to win it, or it's like, let's just try this out. Let's just see. This will be a good thing to do regardless of how we do. Were you in it to win it?
We never set out on this race with the singular goal of coming in first place. For us, this was always about the journey. It was always about being out there together with a group of women and knowing that we pushed ourselves as hard as we could. We planned, and then we planned again, and then we checked our plan. And our goal was really to be out there in a deliberate way and have the boat as ready as it could be, have the crew as ready as it could be, and just experience the beautiful place that we live in together, and push ourselves, push our limits, find out what our limits are. Seek the warrior inside all of us. That was our goal.
And we're all pretty competitive. I mean, yeah. I make yoga competitive. I don't know about you guys.
Our teammate Kate always said, too, she wanted to be able to look back on the race and be able to say, the girls sailed that boat well. And it was, you know, that I think was a goal for us. And just the journey, not just what we did on the water, but it was a journey from finding the boat to the strategy all the way to the end of the race about who's on the crew, yeah. What are you taking with you? And we took the boat apart ourselves and put it back together. And that was a learning experience as well.
Did you win by a large margin, or was it very close at the finish line?
So the boat that came in behind us was just under 2 hours behind. So after 750 miles, you know, it's a long journey to be that close together. Mm-hmm. We had great competitors out there and really enjoyed the experience of being out there with other wonderful teams that were as committed as we were to this spirit of adventure and competition.
And they got steak knives. But for winning the race, what did the Sail Like a Girl team win?
So the winner of this race receives, $10,000 staked to a log. And that's sort of how the race began, when the race organizers said, what would happen if we stuck $10,000 to a tree in Ketchikan? So we did. We received this log, and I wasn't there for
We tried to deposit it at the bank. They wouldn't take it. But we did find some lumberjacks in town at the Ketchikan Lumberjack Show who helped us out. They approached us first with some axes. And we're like, no, we want to save the log. We just need to get the money out. But they were they put it in a vise and were able to pull it out for us.
And what are you going to use the money for? Are you going to continue the team, invest in your success?
So We've committed to, first we need to cover some of our race expenses, but from the very beginning, this race has always been about something much bigger than us. So the proceeds that we raise beyond those expenses will go to support Pink Boat Regatta. All of us, I would say, have been affected by breast cancer in some way or another, whether it is through family members or close friends. None of us are survivors, but Allison works in breast cancer research and does that work. But we've all been touched by it. And so we carried the messages of women that have been affected. We carried their names with us down below in the boat on the mast, trying to draw strength from them when we were really facing tough times. So donating those additional proceeds to Pink Boat Regatta to support the Breast Cancer Research Foundation was a way that we felt we could honor the fact that this was something well beyond just us.
I'm talking to Jean, Amy, and Allison, three members of the 8-woman team Sail Like a Girl that just won the race to Alaska. And if you haven't heard about it, this is an incredibly rigorous trip, 1,100 miles from Port Townsend up to Ketchikan, Alaska. 8 women, some of them not very experienced, kind of jumped in and did it and ended up winning it by 2 hours. What was the toughest part of this trip for you? Was there a moment when you may have lost confidence? You're looking at each other.
I would say, this is Jean. For me, I think the hardest part was actually leaving the dock in Victoria. It was hugging my family and going into the unknown. And there's so much fear in that. But what we did is we supported each other and we had a singular goal of completing this race as safely as we could. So being afraid of that and stepping into it and doing it anyway and doing it deliberately and carefully. And I used to say to the team, it's one lamppost at a time. I'm a terrible runner. It's how I run triathlons. If I can just get to the next lamppost. So, you know, you just set those goals out and the fear kind of goes away over time. We certainly had terrifying moments on the boat out there and things that brought out the best, I think, in each one of us and brought our team really strongly together to bring out the best in the boat. But for me, the scariest moment was leaving Victoria and facing the unknown.
How about you, Amy and Allison? Was there a moment where it was a little scary?
Well, I would say,
or a lot scary?
You know, the unknown, this race, the course of this race is known for having gale force winds. It's very unpredictable and things change in an instant. And so I think, you know, it's that again, the unknown. We had collisions and, as you mentioned, wind would come up suddenly. I think, though, you know, if I'm to think about one of the moments that was terrifying was probably the last night as we had hit the log the day before. We weren't sure of the damage to the boat. We knew we weren't taking water on, but we didn't know if there was any structural damage. And we were in some pretty rough seas and the boat was just slamming down onto the waves. And we were on a 3-hour watch schedule, and often you couldn't sleep. This is really a race of sleep deprivation and endurance. So you may have had 2-3-hour blocks in a 24-hour period to sleep, but that didn't mean you got sleep.
Right.
And I had gone down in the middle of the night for a break, took off my wet gear, and crawled into the pipe berth. And they're really like little tiny coffins. And I thought,
that's,
you know,
comforting.
Yeah, we're way out at sea. You know, the chance, if something goes wrong, the chances of somebody getting to us in time are not, they're not good. And so sort of crawling into that space, holding on to my life jacket, that was, you know, that was a scary moment. I think also, the unexpected, we handled all of it very well. But we were navigating using charts. And sometimes things aren't on the charts, and often sailing in the fog and the dark can be eerie and nerve-wracking.
Sure.
It's dark. You can hear sounds. You can hear boats. You can't see them. We had some fish pens that weren't on the charts show up out of nowhere, these two-story buildings floating in the water. And, you know, Jean was driving, and she reacted so quickly and was so smart in her reaction. And we tacked away, and we got out. But we didn't know how far they stretched, and they really went on for a long time. And I think also just the rocks that there's, you're so trying to be so aware, but you're also very sleep deprived.
It might surprise people to know that this award-winning sailing race that you won involved bicycles.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So as you head north, we've talked about the wind and Mother Nature, you never know what you're going to get. And so when those wind dies and you get into currents, you still have to move forward. You still want to get to that dock in Ketchikan. And so teams do whatever it takes to do that. So that ranges from just stand-up paddleboard oars, putting full-on rowing stations on the boats. And then some boats, like ourselves, have pedal drives. And there's a wide variety of those as well. And so we had two custom-built pedal drives, Access Marine and Manhattan Fabrication helped us out with those. And it's crazy because it looks like you've got a recumbent bike and you've got a stand-up, just regular stand-up bike seat. And people are like, what is that thing on the back of that boat? But the thing is it helped us go so much farther, so much faster. I think we spent almost 75 hours, which is about half the time we were out there, on those bikes because we were determined to keep moving forward to our goal in Ketchikan.
Anytime the boat speed dropped below 5 knots, we would jump on the bikes. And there wasn't a set rotation. It was just sort of as long as you could go. As soon as you felt like you needed fresh legs, you'd say tap out and someone else would hop on. But it was also this funny space to be because it was really like two races. Yeah.
So I got to ask you for a final question here. Is Sail Like a Girl, is your team going to retire as victors? You're going to be back again next year. Going to go for two?
We're really figuring things out right now. We feel like this has become something beyond us, and we want to be good stewards of this message of getting women out there seeking adventure, getting out of their comfort zone, facing leadership opportunities, and finding wonderful teams to be a part of. And so there's something that comes next for us, but we are really regrouping as a team and figuring out how we steward that message forward.
Let us know what it is. We'll be anxious
to
find
absolutely.
Out.
Thank sure you.
Three members of Sail Like a Girl, Amy Fulwell, Allison Ekberg Devadladze, and Jeannie Gusev. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Record. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The legend and theorizing about Northwest Skyjacker D.B. Cooper just won't die. In 1971, an unidentified man hijacked a Boeing 727 aircraft between Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington. He extorted $200,000 in ransom and then parachuted out in the evening to an uncertain fate. It's the only unsolved case of air piracy in commercial aviation history. Well, the makers of a new documentary about the hijacking chose the small town of Cleellum, Washington, for their premiere last Saturday. The video suggests we may have been looking for D.B. Cooper and his loot in the wrong place. KUOW's Tom Bonsi has been reporting on the D.B. Cooper story for decades. He took a skeptical look at these new claims.
The makers of the new documentary literally rolled out a red carpet for the sold-out world premiere of D.B. Cooper, The Real Story. It happened at a Cleellum community center. The town in the eastern foothills of the Cascades was chosen deliberately. That's because Cleellum is the closest town to where former Army paratrooper Walter Recca says he landed after he jumped out of a hijacked Boeing 727 with a $200,000 ransom tied to his chest. Decades later, Recca confessed to a close friend and to a niece that he committed the hijacking under the pseudonym Cooper and made a clean getaway. He allowed himself to be recorded by that friend, Carl Lauren, with the understanding that the secret not be revealed until after Recca's death, which came in 2014.
And you could see the cars, though, before you landed on the ground, right?
Yeah. I seen cars, it was in the distance.
So how did you know which way to even walk?
Towards the direction right there where I assumed the cars.
Now, if you remember your D.B. Cooper lore, you know the jump zone has always been assumed to be over southwest Washington, close to Portland. The airline, the FBI, and amateur sleuths have analyzed and reanalyzed the flight path many times. No one else has placed the jump over central Washington. Carl Lauren asserts the FBI bungled this high-profile case or purposely misdirected searchers away from the correct jump zone.
Do I believe that there was a cover-up here? Let me put it this way. It's the only honest answer I can come up with. Okay, D.B. Cooper jumped over Cleellum.
The FBI effectively closed the D.B. Cooper case in 2016. The Bureau says it won't reopen the cold case unless someone comes up with relevant physical evidence, such as the parachutes the hijacker used or ransom money. The makers of this new documentary found neither of those things. Self-appointed investigator Lauren managed to locate an eyewitness who, with some prompting, corroborates Recca's getaway. That eyewitness is a Cleellum musician and former logging company truck driver. Jeff Oshadis now believes he unwittingly helped D.B. Cooper summon a getaway driver to the roadside cafe where they were the only customers on Thanksgiving Eve, 1971.
He come in and first thing he said is, "Hey kid," he says, "where am I?" I said, "You're about 4 miles east of Cleellum." And he says, "If I make a phone call," he says, "can you give a friend of mine directions how to get here to pick me up?" I said, "Sure, no problem."
At the time, the musician didn't suspect the soaking wet, odd, limping man was anything more than a French fry short of a Happy Meal.
Never saw him again, never knew nothing about it. The next day, you know, they're advertising this guy, you know, that jumped out of an airplane and all this on the news media. They're showing, you know, these composite sketches and everything. Didn't look nothing like the man I was sitting with.
I asked Oshadis and other people who attended the premiere whether Cleellum should or would embrace the alleged connection to the D.B. Cooper legend. Martha Wyckoff and Jerry Tone are local farmers.
I'm going to go with it.
I'm convinced.
It's no question.
it's lore in history, and we can't ignore history. We shouldn't ignore it. Got to celebrate it. Got to celebrate it and let everybody know.
There's already a song to celebrate this new version of events, co-written by Jeff and Darian Oshadas.
This is how the story goes about the money and the man.
The three-hour-long D.B. Cooper documentary will be released online via Amazon, iTunes, and Google Play on Thursday. I'm Tom Bonsi in Cle Elum, Washington.
The secret's out. The story has been told.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill, Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Bill's back on Monday. Join us tomorrow for Week in Review. Bernard Ouellette is navigating. I'm your captain this week, Ross Reynolds. It's The Record.